Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, ranked number one podcast by Canadian financial advisors in the 2021 Environics Advisor Digital Experience Study. Today, we welcome back Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, Urien Timmer. This global macro and markets update was recorded on Monday, September 20th, a day that experienced some volatility in the markets. Urien dives into why and looks at what the major narrative is in the markets right now. Is it from the potential collapse of a major Chinese real estate developer? Or is it more central banks? Or the ups and downs of economic reopenings and dealing with the Delta variant in parts of the world? Urien notes to host Pamela Ritchie that the S&P 500 had tested its 50-day moving average several times over the past year, and every time it survived it to make new highs. Monday, September 20th was the first time in a year where it was below the 50-day moving average. Among other topics, Urien also looks at emerging markets, unpacks if we're experiencing a shorter business cycle than past cycles, and looks at how the Delta variant has been affecting hospitalizations and restrictions. As mentioned, this podcast was recorded on September 20th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Welcome to you, Urien, from Dublin.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm here to visit my son who goes to college here, and we're having a great time. Dublin is alive and well, very busy, plane was full, hotel is full. It's nice to see Ireland recovering from a really severe lockdown that lasted a number of months, so it's good stuff.
That's great. Yeah, that's what I understood. Well, very glad to see you and to have you join us. Okay, so we also had been setting up, Urien, for, I mean, just an incredible number of central banks issuing their decisions ultimately, including the Fed this week. What is the major narrative in the markets, though? Is it, in fact, the Evergrande story that we're mentioning in the introduction, or is it more central banks? What do you make of this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's been a combination of things, right? I mean, at some point, it was the Delta variant, but I think the evidence is showing that that wave is starting to roll over in the U.S., and it's doing so without ever having caused a lockdown, right? So the economy remained fairly open, and now if the Delta wave is subsiding, then it can remain open. So that was one part of the narrative that I think is kind of come and gone. Another one, of course, is the Fed. You know, the Fed has a pretty tight window here. If it's going to raise rates in 2023, it needs to taper first. I mean, that's the conventional wisdom, at least. And it didn't announce a taper at Jackson Hole. It didn't do it at the September FOMC, or not likely to do it at the FOMC. But it needs to get going because it has to go from $120 billion a month to zero before, presumably, it starts raising rates in a year and a half. So it has to thread that needle. But now we have, you know, the news out of China. You know, nobody really knows whether Evergrande, that potential debt default, will be systemic or not. You know, people are calling it kind of China's Lehman moment, but we've had many Lehman moments in China over the years, and usually they kind of just go away, right? So the government backstops it somehow. You know, one of the big policy banks makes a new loan at a longer maturity and a lower interest rate, and then the government just provides the funding to that bank to keep it whole. But of course, we have a whole different dynamic now, because now we have policy in China being much more hardline, kind of, you know, almost kind of an anti-capitalist type of, or more, really more state-sponsored capitalism than a little bit more of that entrepreneurial capitalism. So it's totally unclear whether Evergrande will actually get bailed out or not, and whether maybe parts of it get bailed out, the domestic parts, but that the foreign bondholders get left holding the bag. That's not a prediction, but it's just nobody really knows. And I think that's kind of spooking the markets here. And of course, on top of that, it's September. We know about the seasonals. We've been talking about them. The S&P had tested the 50-day moving average a number of times over the past year, and every time it survived it and then made new highs. Today it went below it. And so this is the first time in a year where we're actually below the 50-day. Maybe we'll test the 200-day, which would be the first kind of bona fide 10% correction that we will have seen if it happens in a year. And so there's a lot of balls in the air right now.
To an extent, it feels like you in your webcast, all of us have been telegraphing that this is at least, if it's not likely, it certainly fits with the overall story. We've had a shorter cycle, many will say, or we've gotten to mid-cycle in a faster fashion. Therefore, it brings things forward. You've been talking about this for some time. How does this, what we're looking at today, fit into ultimately the story you've been going through?
Yeah, you know, it really is pretty wild. And actually, in some ways, it makes the U.S. cycle, or maybe the Western, the developed cycle, actually look more like the Chinese cycle. You know, in Boston here, we have a term for it. It's called the CRIC cycle, the crisis response improvement complacency. And China has had this CRIC cycle, and it's a much shorter cycle. It's kind of 2 years instead of the typical 4 to 5 years. And what happens, you know, something blows up. They respond with some kind of policy stimulus or easing. You get a rapid improvement. Then everything kind of gets quiet. People get complacent. And then the cycle kind of starts all over again. And the U.S. maybe is going through something more like that. And of course, one of the hallmarks of the pandemic, you know, cycle last year into this year is that the policy response, both fiscal and monetary, was so immense and so rapid and so big that it's almost as if where you normally have a cycle that's a bell curve, right? Mid cycle in the middle, the downside, the downturn in the left tail, and then the late cycle in the right tail where the economy overheats and becomes inflationary. It's almost like the policy response has truncated that left tail, and that gets us faster to the right tail because 18 months after being down 35% and the economy being basically in a self-induced depression. Here we are with late cycle wage pressures, you know, labor shortages, inflation, Fed tapering. And, you know, again, I don't think the Fed taper is necessarily a bad thing for the markets. I think as long as it's telegraphed, the markets can handle it. But it's just amazing how quickly we went from one extreme now to the other. And it does hearken kind of that Chinese CRIC cycle a little bit, where policy becomes a much bigger factor in swinging the markets than maybe it has been in the past.
Interesting. And you're talking about monetary policy there, but I wonder about the fiscal policy. How much of the market movements right now to the downside are influenced by waiting on a fiscal package in terms of spending, in terms of infrastructure, waiting on taxes, how much of that filters through to the action we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is a lot of balls up in the air. The sausage making machinery in Washington is never a pleasant thing to watch, and certainly, you know, this time is no exception. But you know, we have the infrastructure bill that's presumably moving forward, but we have the debt ceiling, and then we have this the American Families Plan that, you know, will be a reconciliation plan. And so they're really threading the needle to look kind of like the Fed is, right? Because the infrastructure bill is bipartisan, Democrats, Republicans, you know, the old fashioned way in Washington, the way it should be. And then right on the heels of that getting passed, the House will bring forward its very ambitious plan, but that will be just Democrats going through the reconciliation process. So, but it's like, you know, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party wants to make sure that other legislation, like they don't want to vote for the infrastructure unless they have some assurance that the other part of it is coming right after it. And so it's a real game of chicken. But from what we're seeing, the latest is that the latest proposal is a little bit downscaled from the numbers we saw earlier, and that the tax part of it is also downscaled, right? And so I think the market generally is okay with it. They're expecting it. I mean, you just look at the 10-year yields at 132 today. It's not really going anywhere right now. And it comes back to the stock versus flow argument, which is a very old debate. So you could say, and the same thing applies to the Fed, right? So the Fed can say, we have $8.5 trillion in terms of assets. So who cares if we reduce our asset purchases from 120 to zero? But the flow people will say, no, it's that incremental increase in the balance sheet that is what really pushes the needle. And on the fiscal side, it's the same thing, right? So there will be another big deficit this year and probably next year, but it will be less big than last year. So from a flow perspective, it is less stimulative. And even though it's on an absolute term, it's still very large. So there's a lot of different ways to spin this, but my guess is that the fiscal side is not really moving the needle right now.
So let's talk a little bit about sector correlations. They're traditional, what you see when there's sort of a risk off moment or a risk on moment. Take us through, I know you have a chart on that, and then we'll also probably talk about the seasonality of what we're watching.
So Urien has a few charts he'll be sharing today, so please head to @TimmerFidelity on Twitter to follow along. The first slide here to reference is Sector Correlations, which was tweeted by Urien on September 23rd.
What I show here is the 52-week correlation of sector relative returns to the S&P 500 against changes in the five-year treasury yield. And I use the five-year instead of the 10-year because the five-year is more influenced by Fed policy, because what the Fed does in terms of forward guidance and asset purchases affects the what we call the belly of the curve more so than the long end of the curve. And what you see is kind of what we already know. You know, cyclical sectors like energy and financials are positively correlated to changes in interest rates, meaning if rates go up, because inflation is going up or growth is going up, energy and financials will tend to benefit on a relative basis. And the bottom part of that chart shows that, the bond proxies, the stable quality stocks like consumer staples, utilities, as well as large cap growers like tech, healthcare, for instance, those are negatively correlated. And so if yields fall, kind of investors seek shelter in those sectors. And again, you know, we all know this, and we know that over the past, you know, few months, that's exactly what has happened, because the 10-year yield peaked at 175 about 6 months or so ago, or 4 months ago, and has been coming down, and it's been large cap growth that has been dominating. So if, you know, I'm not predicting that we're going to see a more severe correction than what we're seeing today, but it's very, very plausible that after not having a 10% correction in a year, that maybe we get that. So if we see more downside towards the 200-day moving average, for instance, which is around 4,100 on the S&P, and I think we're around 4,300 right now, you could argue that we'll see a dip in yields as that happens, because investors will worry about future economic growth, especially with the Evergrande story and the Fed taper story. And so you could see actually this large cap growth and the quality stocks, the bond proxies, continue to do well.
Up next, please take a look at Sector Dispersions, which was tweeted the afternoon of September 22nd.
It's interesting that, you know, when you have these corrections, and again, I don't want to overplay this. I'm bullish. I've been bullish. I think whatever correction we get will be just that. But you do see that historically, and this chart goes back, I think, to the 1920s. This is a weekly chart, and it shows the dispersion of weekly relative returns of the 11 sectors in the S&P relative to the S&P 500. And so what you can see, this kind of looks like the VIX, if you will. So the extremes at the bottom, when there's very little dispersion, is that there's only about a 1% difference between the best performing and the worst performing sector on a weekly basis. We're currently at 5%, which is dead neutral. So that's very much on average. But you can see that when you get these downturns, and I'm not talking about, you know, the financial crisis, or just regular old 10, maybe 15% corrections, you see that sector dispersion spike up. And what that tells you is that people start hiding out in the safe stocks and they sell their cyclicals. And we're not seeing it yet. We're still at 5. But if this correction got more legs, we could very well see a replay of that, which would create opportunities at the end of the day to maybe re-rotate into value and cyclicals.
Fascinating. That's interesting. Like, because the valuations we've been talking about for some time are high. There are people who want to get in, but things are just too expensive. Something that you've been looking at an awful lot this year is the crypto space. It's interesting in a moment like this to see what it does, what gold is holding. What do you notice there, having you know, spent some real time looking at it this year? What does this moment mean for crypto and gold?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about crypto is that there is the actual use case. You get the network effect, you get the supply scarcity, and those are all very, very potent forces, I think. But it's also a new asset, and it kind of lends itself to speculation, because every new asset lends itself to speculation. So you go through these boom bust cycles, and, you know, at 65,000 Bitcoin back in April, I guess it was, there were a lot of small players on leverage getting into that space. And then at 30,000, they were all gone. And now we went back to 50,000, and now we're down to 44,000. And so there's every move will get exaggerated because people are piling in on leverage. You know, you have the long-term believers, the hodlers, as we call them, but you also have the tourists who just come along for the ride and they buy it because it's going up. They may have no idea what they're buying, but if it's going up, they're buying it. And those are the people that get flushed out. So today, during kind of a major risk off type of day, the true believers in Bitcoin and other cryptos would say, this is when it should be going up, because it's like, see, we can't trust the default system. But the fact that Bitcoin is down just as much, if not more, as the stock market tells you that there is that boom bust dimension to it, where people chase momentum. And you know, when that margin call comes, it comes fast and furious.
Very interesting. Yeah, good to know that. Well, let's go to something that we really need an update on Delta, actually, and sort of how that has been playing out in terms of hospitalizations, lockdowns. People don't like that word, restrictions. How are the two of those moving the economy in the US and elsewhere?
Okay, let's take a look at Urien's slide tweeted on September 21st, titled US Lockdown Index versus Hospitalizations.
And I think, you know, it's interesting because this is a really, I hate to say it's a good story, because it's a story that's getting less bad, and that's not always the same as good. But there's definitely a flip side to it. So if you look at this chart, and again, I was really taken aback by this Delta variant. I saw the wave coming, but I did not see the hospitalizations coming, because I was assuming that the US, and these are data for the US, would kind of follow the UK story. So the UK followed India with the Delta variant, and the UK saw a lot of new cases, but not a lot of hospitalizations. And so I figured, you know, the US is maybe 4 weeks behind the UK, so we'll see the same, and then it'll be over. And that was not the case. We did see the wave of new cases, but we also saw a big wave in hospitalizations. So the gray bars in this chart measure the percentage of US hospital beds occupied by COVID patients. And so the third wave, that big one in the middle, that was over the winter, peaked at 18.4%. So 18% of hospital beds were occupied by COVID patients. It collapsed all the way to 2% in June, and it recently went up to 14.2%, which is a really big increase. And I think the reason is, you know, I figured it's all going to be, you know, basically healthy young people getting infected and they don't go to the hospital. But in the U.S., of course, we have some states that are more vaccinated than others. I live in Massachusetts, which I think is the highest vaccination state in the country. But there are other states like Florida that are not. And a lot of the hospitalizations did not come from Massachusetts, but came from Florida and other kind of, I hate to call them red states, but that's kind of how we are dividing this these days. And so we did see the hospitalizations, but what we did not see is new restrictions on the economy. So that blue line there is the Goldman Sachs effective lockdown index. So it's their method of measuring, how open or closed the economy is. So a very high reading means the economy is locked down. So that was earlier last year. And a low reading is that the economy is relatively open. And so you can see in the bottom right there that this big wave in hospitalizations did not cause renewed lockdown. So the economy basically stayed as open as it did 6 months ago. And we have this data for every country in the world, and other countries did not necessarily show the same result. But for the US, being the largest economy in the world, it is good to see that this wave was just a wave of COVID and not a new wave of lockdowns. But the flip side of that is that now that the wave seems to be cresting, and you can kind of see that from the chart, we're not going to get that big tailwind of the economy reopening and then producing all of this activity, because it never really went away in the first place. So I do think that's a bit of a counterbalance to what should be good news in terms of the Delta variant now receding.
So you showed that chart just earlier with the various different regions of the world. The dollar is sort of the story within that. We are seeing the dollar surge today. It's a safe haven mm-hmm. asset. Yeah. What ultimately does it mean for the question of EM right now? That ultimately you'll probably be a buyer depending on how things go here. But EM is sort of its own case because COVID is obviously taking place in places where their vaccinations are low.
Yeah, so EM, EM's been a bit of a frustration story. Its long-term chart has looked really good. I've been bullish on it, but obviously the news out of China, and China being a large chunk of the EM index, has really, caused EM to underperform. And then on top of that, we had dollar strength, and we had, of course, the FANG stocks, the large cap U.S. growth stocks, doing extremely well and kind of taking, share away not only from U.S. value, but also international. The way I like to think about it is I don't want to bet against the large growers in the U.S. because their ability to produce free cash flow and to return the free cash flow that they don't need for acquisitions or capital spending, they return that to shareholders via buybacks indirectly. So that's a very powerful story. And it's kind of my overall secular theme, right? You have aging demographics, people's looking for yield. You have extremely low interest rates. I don't have the chart. Sorry. You have extremely low interest rates because of the debt overhang. And then you have these stocks that produce all this cash flow because they have gigantic networks, these huge moats around them that can't be penetrated. And they're returning shareholder value back to shareholders. So those three things combined is what forms my secular thesis. But at the same time, we have inflation, we have an economy that has been reopening, and an economic cycle that presumably will come back to life, around the world. And so then you want to bet on the more cyclical side. I want to bet against the dollar because I do think the Fed is going to end up like the Bank of Japan and own and basically tame the bond market into submission. So I want my cake and eat it too. I want that large U.S. growth story. But I also want the EM story as a play on all the other things that I just mentioned.
Right.
I guess that's a long way of saying I want a diversified portfolio, which is probably what we should all have anyway.
Well, we're very pleased to have you join us anytime you're available. But on a day where we're seeing lots of action, it's really helpful to have those charts to anchor everything that you say and what investors are watching. Urien Timmer, thank you for joining us.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much, Urien Timmer, for joining us. Thanks for joining us here today. I'm Pamela Ritchie.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you next time.